Hey friends, welcome back. The Ortho Talk podcast, episode number 17. This week we have a very special guest with us, Dr. Amelia Beakey. Dr. Beakey is a physician. She is a blogger, a podcaster, and the creator of This Osteopathic Life, which is a physician life coaching service. What does a physician life coach do? Well, they help physicians deal with things like burnout, mental health, and other issues that they may be going through. This is a very informative podcast, very great podcast. We talk about physician burnout, mental health, things particular to surgeons, including loss of confidence, things like that. And I think you guys will really like this one. If you want to get in touch with Dr. Beakey, you can do so at her website, thisosteopathiclife.com. If you want to check out all of our episodes, you can do that at orthotalkpod.com. And just a friendly reminder that we are looking for residency programs to showcase on our website. If you would like to do so, just get in touch with us at Twitter, OrthotalkPod, at OrthotalkPod on Twitter, and we'll get you involved in that. So hope you guys enjoy this podcast. Very informative. And without further ado, Dr. Amelia Beakey. Hey, can we time out? All right. All good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is time out. This is the OrthoTalk podcast. Today we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course, what do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision.
Welcome to the OrthoTalk podcast. You're here with myself and my co-host, Asif Khalid. And we have a very special guest for you guys this week. It's episode 17, which is a prime number, I just realized. But also, there's a topic that our viewers have asked us to touch upon. And we originally started this podcast as a way to talk about the issues in orthopedics and orthopedic training outside of actual orthopedics. And this is one of the topics that we really wanted to cover. So today we're going to talk about burnout, mental health, imposter syndrome, and those aspects, which all of us have some personal experience with at some level or another. But rather than just inviting another random orthopod like myself or Asad, we thought we should do the topic justice and invite a true expert. So we are very honored today to have Dr. Beakey with us. Dr. Beakey is a neuromuscular skeletal doctor, but she also does physician coaching on the side, and she specifically coaches physicians who are going through issues involved in mental health. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And I know I'm in the right place because numbers and patterns and prime numbers are totally my jam. So.
Yeah.
It's a good start to the evening. Yeah.
Absolutely. How did you get involved in this?
In physician coaching? Well, yeah. It's been interesting because I realized in my practice, I've actually been coaching the whole time. So in NMM and osteopathic manipulative medicine, which is the tool that I have to treat patients, people come to me with pain, and I'm often telling them that they have the answer to their pain. And they'll come to me expecting the fix or the solution. And it's really this dialogue, and it works in medicine. But as I moved into coaching, I realized that's really the expectation. You know, coaching is about showing people their greatness within, that they do have the tools they need to be successful. But sometimes we get in our own way, and we need someone to help us kind of filter through thoughts and organize in a fashion that allows us to really tap into that potential. And moving into this allows me to serve my colleagues. I've been a residency program director in the past and worked in administration, and I've been looking for a way to have a wider reach and to really bring health to medicine. And I found that coaching has been an effective tool to do so.
So Dr. Beakey, where did you find this passion for helping other physicians like that? When did you first realize, like, hey, this is something I want to do? You know, what kind of set that fire?
I think from the beginning, you know, so the reason I chose osteopathic medicine as my path was because it was health focused. And I noticed that the principles of things like seeing body, mind, and spirit integration, that people have the inherent capacity to be well, I thought, well, this could be applied to everything, right? To systems and not just people. And I think about that in healthcare. You know, if we look at how can healthcare itself be well in an education. And right now we're noticing that education policy really is health policy in the country. And how can we focus on the health and either of those? And I've held courses in different ways and worked with colleagues, but I was seeking an effective tool, a tangible tool to implement it so you could get to results quickly. You can get to them effectively and on a broader scale And that's where coaching has really been an asset for me in this way.
So this might seem like a silly question, but what is burnout? Because I think everyone has their own definition of burnout, and it might mean different things to different people. But in your world, what constitutes burnout?
Yeah, burnout. It's a buzzword. People are tired of the word. There's been the challenge of taking burnout and looking at moral injury instead. And in medicine in particular, what I see as burnout is when what you're doing no longer matches what you thought you'd be doing. And the why of what you're doing no longer matches the why of what you intended to. And like anytime we have disappointment, it's when our reality doesn't match our expectation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of what happens in medicine is we had a picture of why we went into it, right? To help people, to build our skills, to innovate. And if what we end up doing is a lot of paperwork and chasing numbers and not being valued for the care that we provide or not being seen as a unique individual, there's a mismatch. And it's kind of like if you're a little bit off in the groove, you get some rubbing, right? And I'm talking to ortho here, right? So we know when we start to get the wear of the cartilage, when things aren't quite aligned, right? When there's a little bit of a mismatch of how things are supposed to work, that's to me where burnout really happens.
Yeah. What you described can be like 98% of physicians right now. That's kind of scary.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of us, I don't know when that time hits where we realize that medicine isn't what we thought it was. For me, it was probably pretty early, but I had a lot of people kind of tell me, and especially along the interview trail, like a lot of it was geared to, do you really know what you're getting yourself into? Do you really have a good reason for doing this? And for me, it was kind of early, but I think a lot of people that kind of hits late, and sometimes maybe even when they're in practice and they realize that, most of their time is spent charting and doing peer-to-peers and not actually taking care of many people. So it's kind of scary because by that definition, I would say almost every physician has burnout.
Yeah. And it can seem scary, or it's also important just to have awareness, right? Because we often think of burnout at the extreme where we're ready to leave clinical medicine, certainly the very dire end. And we know, physicians have a high suicide rate, and it's everywhere in between, right? That it's from that altruistic, everything is matching up, that's where we're kind of pretty much at zero on the burnout scale to the extreme, but there's a whole lot in between. And just being aware of that allows us to have interventions, that are meaningful along the way, and to know you don't have to tip into that farthest edge of it, and that we can seek help and even just support, right? You often think help, nobody really wants to ask for help necessarily, but just to be supported all along the way and to have those check-ins, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? And it doesn't mean we don't have to do charts or, we have to hate charting. It's actually possible. We have physician coaches who specifically talk about that, how to make peace with charting, how to love charting if we want to go there. But we can be where we are and suffer less. It really is possible, even if the system doesn't change, although my purpose is also to help support an improved system.
So how do you, you talked a lot about awareness, and I think that's great, but how do you know, we all have ups and downs. We have good days, bad days. Some days we just don't feel like going to work. Some days we love being at work. And how do you know what's kind of normal day-to-day stuff? And how do you know when it's gone to burnout, or is it all a spectrum? How do you think of it like that?
I definitely think of it on a continuum. And, for coaching, it's certainly not a replacement for mental health services. It's not a replacement for psychology or psychiatry intervention. And so we can look at our classic markers, of depression, and when we're no longer doing things that we like to do, when our energy levels have dropped, if we're having things like weight loss and we're not engaging in our relationships. So those are some of those red flags that we probably need more significant intervention. But looking for those early signs of burnout, kind of the canary in the cave, is how many days out of the week did I really not want to go to work? If it's occasional, fair enough. If I'm tired after call, no big deal. If I had a tough outcome, can I bounce back from that? How long am I perseverating on a case that maybe didn't go as well as I thought? And the other thing I think to pay attention to is whose values am I following? And we're kind of yes people, right? People ask us to do things and we want to show up and do them. And that's great. But notice if the yes has started to take you off course, because one yes might be okay, but 180 yeses might take you totally in the opposite direction of where you wanted to be. And so just looking for that, am I saying yes because I choose to do it? Am I saying yes because I think I have to do it? I'm saying yes to avoid, you know, a punishment, and beginning to tune into that, I think, is a way to catch burnout before it becomes more dire.
So I want to circle back to something you said, I think maybe two questions ago, and regarding the term burnout and maybe replacing it with something like moral injury. And I, you know, I read this article on Kevin MD, I think you pronounced the name Dr. Weibel, but basically she equates burnout to a human rights violation in medicine. Do you think that's taking it too far, or is there any truth to that?
I think that's definitely part of it. I'm also currently an osteopathic health policy fellow, and we look at the systemic components. And if you look at all those things, right, charting and work hours and pay and, you know, fee for service, it does sound like things that are human rights conditions. You know, when we talk about why should physicians unionize or not unionize, and those are things that unions would advocate for, yeah, right? Fair working environment. And so I think, yes, absolutely. But I think the place we have to really make improvement, because we need the system to change, but we don't have to suffer while we're waiting for it to happen, because we know the rate of change is slow, you know, on the institutional right. level, in the federal level, even in the state and, you know, regional levels of regulation changes. But we can know that they're not our fault, you know, and that we're not personally subject to them in the way that these incidents, insults, can't deplete our worthiness. And that's the one thing I really try to reiterate with physicians, is that your worthiness is 100% out the gate. It can't be increased, it can't be decreased. And when we're based on external markers of achievement, it's hard to believe that. It's like, no, I get the test score, you know, I get the match, I get this award for teaching, you know, I'm the fastest in the OR. Those are the things that we associate with achievement and worthiness, but those are ands. You know, our worthiness is 100% no matter what, and we can work toward those. So when we notice that, and we notice, okay, the system, the survey with 2 stars instead of 5, yeah, you know, you're behind on the charting, all of those can't decrease my worthiness. So I can stand in that and work for change. And I think that's where we have an opportunity to, yes, shift. And I would agree with Dr. Weibel that there is an element of human rights violations in medicine. And we've seen that, right? We've shifted work hour requirements because they were inhumane and they aren't present in any other industry. Right. And so, yes, and, right, we have the opportunity to shift them without suffering all along the way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So do you think there's a better word than burnout that we should be using? Is moral injury really a better word?
I think moral injury is nice. It gives it some space that it's not your fault. I think the concern with burnout is it's like a victim blaming phrase. Yeah. I don't think it has to be. And I think it just can be a way to recognize, when is my light going dim, right? You know, that's why I think of burnout. If I'm this bright light and I'm brilliant and I'm passionate and I'm caring for people, how close is it to being snuffed out?
Yeah.
And how can I rekindle it? How can I nurture it? How can I protect it, right? If we're out in the wind, we got to have something around, you know, the fire to keep it intact. Right. And so I think it's okay if we all start to say, burnout doesn't mean, right, I'm the problem. I'm too vulnerable. I'm not resilient enough. Yeah. I think almost resilience has taken on a harder way to manage it. Because it's like, well, if you could just handle things better,
right,
you wouldn't burn out.
If you're tougher, if you have thicker skin, that kind of stuff, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Resilience is such an interesting concept as it relates to burnout. You know, just today I saw on social media one of our leadership meetings in orthopedics, just talking about how important resilience is in trainees and trying to find trainees who are resilient, and how kind of the current generation of people growing up in medicine, you know, are not as resilient as they used to be. You know, I read all these thoughts today on social media, but are we placing too much importance on resilience to the point where we're starting to feel bad about ourselves if we're not resilient? What do you think?
I think resilience is the place where we allow that toxic culture to persist. So if we're looking for resilient people, all it's saying is we're going to let the culture not change at all and just look for the people that'll keep putting up with abuse, you know, and that's really what is happening. When we look and shift to worthiness, what I like to think of is building immunity to burnout, and immutable worthiness that can't be denied, you know, is very different than building up resilience, right? Having to kind of grow that thick skin, because worthiness allows you to still be human and vulnerable within, but it's kind of like this outer casing that's protective. And it's one that doesn't, it doesn't matter what's happening. You know, you didn't become worthy because you survived all those insults, or you stayed up, you know, 57 hours for a shift. It's just there and it's intact. And if we all begin to honor that in ourselves and speak it to one another, I picture it that rather than having these resilient people, we just have these people that can't be invaded anymore by these toxic systems. You know, like those viruses won't have a host anymore. And that's where the toxic culture will begin to fall away. Because right now it preys on our willingness, or not even, you know, unknowing willingness, subconscious willingness to accept what's asked of us. You know, and I think in the new generation, as a residency program director, relatively young, I could even see in the people I was training, they were less willing to tolerate it, right? They wanted to know very clearly when they were going to go home. And we might have thought, well, that's not okay, right? You should stay until I say you can go. But it's actually quite reasonable, you know, unless, of course, there are emergent situations, but it's pretty reasonable to have an expected schedule for the day, you know. And the more people that stand in that, I think the better off we're going to be in medicine, because the systems will then have to adapt to us rather than us having to adapt to a toxic system.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is there's kind of a fine line between work duties and, you know, inhumane work requirements, I guess, right? How do you, I mean, obviously this is going to be different for each specialty, but I mean, if you're a resident, how can you be the one to take a stand when everyone else around you is, you know, staying for that, you know, extra two cases in the middle of the night and disregarding their family? But, you know, you're the one that, you know, if you want to go home at five, you get viewed on as being lazy, not wanting to do the work, not wanting to pull your weight, right? I mean, there's this entire peer pressure from, you know, the group within to not be that person. And without a collective change and a collective shift in the psychology of the group, you're stuck, right? So your options at that point, if you know you're that person, it's either to not pursue that specialty and go to something like ER or anesthesia that's defined shift work, or to try to grin and bear it out and, you know, make it through and maybe sacrifice a little bit of yourself to get to a point where you're your own boss and you can make your own hours, right?
Yeah, and there's definitely going to be that little bit of incongruence in the early times when we're challenging it, just like we've seen with work hours, you know, shifts. You know, when that first came to be, there are people who are like, I'm gonna stay anyway, right? Like, I'm just gonna ignore all that and just stay. But I think if you consider it as to why am I staying? Am I staying because someone else said I should? You know, if there is a requirement, right? If you're on call, obviously there are times when you're responsible, you're the person there and you stay. But if you're staying because someone else told you should, because you think it will get you extra marks, you know, look at what the driver is. What is the why? And is it serving you? Are you choosing it? And you may be able to shift your response, even if it is, yes, I want to stay because I want to get as many cases as I can, and I'm willing to do this. It may feel very different than if it's like, like, well, they're all staying, so I'm going to stay too. Yeah. So even if you do nothing different, changing how you think about it can alleviate some of that stress. You say, and you can do a check-in, right? Actually, I'm okay today, right? I've slept enough. I don't have any family obligations. I have some food available here. I can handle this. And I'm choosing to stay versus I have to stay because somebody else said that I should and hate every moment of it. Your learning is actually probably going to be less too. Yeah. And so our choice is when we have a result we don't like, and if the result is staying over, we can either change our thought about it, even if we do stay, or we can change what we do, you know, and not stay and accept that, yes, people might have thoughts about it. I don't have to be subject to the effect of those thoughts.
Yeah.
And if it's your grader, right, if it's your attending, right, that can be challenging if they're going to evaluate you or write a letter of recommendation for your job. But perhaps, you never know, maybe they respect you for just saying, thank you, you know, this is as much as I can handle today. I look forward to being here tomorrow. And perhaps, right, you'll start to shift that culture and give permission, because your classmate might really need to go home, right? They might just be spent. It might be their kid's dance recital, and you might be making space for them to be brave enough to step into that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And
that's a great response. Yeah,
I think that's something I've unknowingly done in the past. And you're right, it totally shifts your perception of why you're there. Because, you know, there's times where, you know, I had to go cover a case or do something I just didn't really want to do. And eventually, it wasn't really self-thought or self-reflection that brought it, but me complaining to either a co-resident or a co-fellow. And, you know, they're like, well, you know, you're really just doing it so that, you know, you'd give a good impression and you need it for future job recommendations and things like that. And then when you put it like that, yeah, I guess it makes sense. And it just makes it a lot more bearable. So yeah, that's a great response. Something that
that's an awesome response.
I didn't really think.
And you can still choose that, right? If getting a good letter of recommendation is a goal, great. But just own it, you know.
It kind of puts yourself back in the control, right? I think I think especially as surgeons, we're kind of control freaks. So once that control is taken out of our hands, things become a little more painful. But you kind of shift it back into I'm doing this for me. I guess it makes it a little better.
Absolutely, and that's really a great comparison for burnout too. It is when we think we have no control, you know, and working with students right now has been so enlightening because of course, right? An M1, like they think they got nothing, like everybody's in charge of them, but they do, right? They can still control how much they study. They can still control what they say. They can bring their ideas, you know, just remembering that worthiness is intact all throughout the training and new perspectives are so important and being willing to bring them is what's going to give us solutions because we need new thinkers, right? We need different problem solvers in medicine. And so just remembering that, like you have something to contribute along the way and keep looking for how can I regain control in this situation? And especially I think in the surgical specialties, I just put an article out in Kevin MD about this, is that we are responsible for outcomes, which is so interesting, right? Outcomes-based reimbursement. When we know how many variables there are in an outcome of a surgical case, totally beyond your control, right? What the patient did going in, what happens in the room, like infection rates, if that's a measure of your success, it's absurd because you cannot control everything that goes into it. You can control what you can, right? You can operate with a sterile field and you can be meticulous and you can check on the wound and you can have good helpers, but it's beyond your control. And so stepping back in and say, what actually am I responsible for here? Because responsibility and power are meant to be intertwined. And when we start to separate them, when we take responsibility for something we really can't control, we've given all our power away.
Yeah.
And so starting to reclaim that for the patients too, right? What are they actually responsible for in their care, and what is the insurance system actually responsible for, and what is the hospital actually responsible for? And we can stay in our own spheres, we can still work together, but not just say to the physician, you know, whatever happens here, it's on you, you know. And it's great when it works, right? When you have an amazing outcome and they're out on the same day from a total hip, you're like rock star, but you're also subject to that pendulum swing the other way. And so rather stay in that space. I did everything I could today. I was prepared. I was meticulous. I was kind to the patient and pre-op. I rounded on them. I was successful today, you know, and you can hold on to that piece.
Those are great thoughts. One thing you mentioned was how you tell your clients and physicians about self-worth and worthiness. Do you ever have people come to you and kind of give you pushback on that in terms of, you know, how can I have self-worth if I'm doing this poorly at this, or, you know, like how do you fight those responses? How do you get around those?
Absolutely. In medicine, it's challenging because we've been told it is the external markers, right? It's the grades and boards and reviews and rankings and matches. And so it does take some rebuilding and reminding people that all of those are external markers. And you can put as much value on them as you want. You can put as much effort toward them as you want. But this is where the and only is one of the key tools that I find works with people, is just like we said with the outcomes, right? So what is actually within your control here? And what can you decide is a marker of success? And certainly if you're behind, right? If you're behind where you would be on these performance measures, you can say, I would like to, right? Perform. I'm in the 30th percentile. I want to get to the 50th by the end of the year and the 70th by the next year. You can look at that and then put some actions into place to get there, all along the way knowing I am still 100% worthy, right? My excellence as a surgeon needs work, but that is not determining my personal worthiness. And you'll operate, pun intended, from a very different place if you're doing this because, right, I'm building skills toward this external outcome. It has nothing to do with who I am as a human, but is where I'm choosing to go professionally. You'll show up less scared. It's kind of going to an audition versus a performance, right? In an audition, everyone wants to catch everything out, but they want to hear every mistake. But a performance, they'll kind of gloss over it because they want you to do well. And you kind of shift that perspective. Like, I'm showing up doing the best I can today. I'm doing the best I can tomorrow. And I'm going to grow from there. But if you imagine when you're feeling scared and insecure, it goes worse, right? Like, your cases on the days when you're like, I've only done one of these, usually things go worse, right? You know, you drop stuff and things you normally would do totally fine go poorly. Right. But if you show up and you're like, I got this, and it has nothing to do with what you've done, you know, 100 or not. I mean, it has some skills base, but really your attitude going in is what changes it. You know, I'm fully in charge of this room. I know what I'm doing. I'll ask for the help that I need. You'll show up very differently. And so it does take a lot of work, and that's where coaching comes into play, because it's cleaning up those thoughts and realizing you can choose confidence, right? Which seems kind of unlikely. It's like, no, confidence comes from performing well. Confidence actually comes first, and then you'll perform better.
Yeah, so I think we're skirting on this topic of imposter syndrome here, right? Because it's a feeling that you don't belong, feeling that you're not worthy of the position that you're in. And, you know, for me, and I know for a lot of people, a lot of people, it comes in earlier. For me, and I know for some people I've talked to, it's kind of setting in right now in this transition from fellowship to attending. And when you're going to be the one in charge, and I'm starting to feel it a little bit too, when they're starting to ask me for my preference cards and how I want to set up my clinic and, you know, all that stuff. And, you know, I don't have anyone above me to ask. Well, I can ask them, but to see what they want to do. So yeah, I think this confidence thing, you know, confidence is important. But how do you deal with something like this? Where it's like you said, confidence. Can you build the confidence through experience, or is this something that you're born with and you just kind of have to figure? If you don't have enough, you just figure it out along the way.
Yeah, you know, confidence is a feeling, right? And our feelings come from our thoughts. And so you could shift your experience of confidence right now. Like if you think about the case most recently you felt the most successful, like you walked in the room, you knew exactly what you were going to do. The outcome was great. You know, you told the family everything went perfectly. It was fast. I was out of the room fast. Like what were you thinking when you were feeling confident around that case?
Yeah, I don't know. It's been a while.
Telling yourself as you walked into that room. And honestly, even it might be years back, right?
Yeah. It's honestly probably cases that I've done most of. OJ.
Mo, you've never been confident.
All right, we'll work with you right now. We're gonna build confidence with you right now.
Let's do it.
You know, some of the things you might have told yourself, I know exactly what I'm doing. You know, I'm the right person for this job.
Yeah, so
I have a right to be here.
It's probably the last case I can remember feeling like that was a case that I had done before that went great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew the approach, I knew the anatomy, I knew the fixation technique. I studied it the night before. And I just remember my most recent experience before that was great. So I felt great going in. That's probably what it was.
What case was it?
It was probably distal biceps was the last one I felt really good on.
All right.
And you could be thinking right then, I know I can do this well, right? And you had some past evidence, and that would bring up confidence. And then when you're feeling confident, you show up differently in the room, right? And then everything plays out from there. And so that thought is available to you. I know I can do this well, even if, right? It's a case you only saw once and now you're the lead and, you know, you're going through it, maybe not 100% sure, but I know I can do this well because you get to decide what well is. Mm-hmm. And again, you can get to decide that I'm going to do everything that I know how. And, you know, I'll ask for help right now and I still have it. Even when you're in the room, you're never in the room alone, right? So you always have resources, even if they're not these elevated mentor-based resources. So I know I can do this well is a thought that brings you confidence. And that's always available to you. And sometimes you might have to add a little modifier. I'm willing to believe I know I can do this well. You know, if it's something where you have to kind of get yourself there a little bit. But imposter syndrome for sure comes on strong, especially as we're progressing through, right? We think it's like for the early bird positions. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's for those exactly those transition moments because you're shifting, right, your level of responsibility.
Yeah.
And you're not quite sure you have the power to go with it. And you have to kind of tell yourself that you do. And then it'll happen again when you're a couple years out because you're supposed to have it all like on cruise control by then. Yeah. And then you get a case that's totally like, really have never seen this. I'm the specialist. Like, oh crap. And just saying, okay, I trust myself to learn how to do this well, you know, and you gather some more data and don't be surprised by, I think that's the other thing is to think good doctors don't have imposter syndrome. Totally untrue, right? It's everywhere and expect it to come up. Expect to think, I don't know if I should be doing this. They're going to figure it out, right? I don't really know what I'm doing. I don't remember what we did in that case. You know, all those thoughts, totally normal, right? It's what you do with them. If you let them tell you you're not a worthy surgeon, then that's where the problem comes up. If you let them inform you that you maybe need some more preparation and maybe you need to call a colleague, right? I'd actually do better if I had somebody with me in this case, not because I'm weak, vulnerable, unworthy, but just because that's smart, right? I haven't seen many of these. And it's hard to do that, especially in surgical specialties, to admit, right? I need some help. I need backup. But also think, if you were asked, if someone came to you and said, even as attending to attending, this case is coming up, you know, I'm doing some prep, but man, I think I could use another set of eyes in here. How would you feel if you were the one they were asking?
Feel good.
Right? Yeah. You get to be the expert, you know, and right. And who knows, compensation, responsibility, all that you could work out. And that probably isn't going to happen very often, right? You're not often going to need somebody else to come in there with you, but even though it's available to you, like, what would be the problem with saying one of your colleagues, it'd be great to scrub this together.
Yeah.
You know, and just remember, like, we're supposed to help each other. You know, it's meant to be a collaborative profession. Right. And sometimes we think that means we're not doing well if we're asking for help.
Yeah, well, those are great points. How much variable is that, do you see among surgeons? Because confidence can come from a lot of places, right? I guess for me, the more I think about it, confidence comes from preparation. And the more I prepare, the more confident I feel. But I fully accept that that might not be the case for everyone. So where are some other sources of confidence that, you know, where else can confidence come from?
Yeah. Well, confidence is always coming from your thoughts, you know? And so we often think it's because, right, I've done 100 of these, I'm 10 years out. We pin it to the external circumstance, and that's where we lose control over it. And so absolutely, right, we can say that skills come with experience and repetition, but confidence really doesn't, you know? And we've seen that, right? You can think of a cavalier surgeon who, like, 3 months into intern year thinks they know what they're doing, and they're like, and that borders on arrogance, you know, and that becomes dangerous. Right. And so we know confidence can come without any experience. You know, there are doctors who can be reckless and show up that way. And we can think back in our youth, right? Times we thought we knew stuff, right? We were so confident, it's like, we knew anything, but we told ourselves we did. And so just know it always comes from your thoughts. And some people get to it differently. Somebody else might not have confidence from the thought, I know I can do this well. They may have confidence from the thought, I did this yesterday, or I saw this done and I'm ready to go. And so noticing what thoughts bring it up for you are really what's so important. And if it is, I've done 100 of these, then yes, right? You can know I like to put into place these external factors, but it really isn't those giving me the confidence. Those are giving me the skills and the experience that my brain is going to tell me when I'm confident.
So I need to stop attributing it to something else outside of me. And just confidence comes from what I say. Whenever I say I'm confident, that's confidence.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean, right, turn around and do something you've never done.
Right.
That's arrogance. It's responsibility. And that's the difference. And I think we pin that on surgeons, right?
Yeah.
We have that kind of arrogant surgeon piece. And some of it is a survival tool, right? You're faced with a lot of big things. And you're cutting people open, you know? So you have to have a little bit of capacity with you to do that, you know? But it can stay confident. It doesn't have to go to arrogance. And just noticing when that happens, because confidence, you know, is that security, and you do have some data to back it up, right? You have established the skills for it. Arrogance is when we're like, I'll do anything, you know, because we're kind of just saying, it doesn't matter what happens, you know, I'm good, I got this. And so just checking yourself with that, you know, if you begin to notice, you know, should I be confident here? is that actually going to serve the patient? Because if I'm operating outside of something that I do have the experience to do, and that's where I think sometimes push ourselves, right? When if you are assigned a case and you're like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be the one. You just kind of bolster it up versus being able to say, actually, right, it'd be responsible to require and request support in that situation.
Well, that's a very interesting point on confidence. It's something I never really thought of before.
So one thing I've heard senior surgeons say, just, you know, off the cuff, is they'll say, you're only as good as your last case, you know? So if they had you've heard this, Mo, right?
Yeah.
So if you have a bad outcome, what do you do if you have, let's say you have two or three cases in a row, whether or not you're a resident or an attending, you just had about, you know, two or three bad cases in a row, you start getting down on yourself.
No, that happens, right? Because I know residents younger than us that have had just complication after complication.
Oh, yeah.
And they've switched specialties based on the complications they had in that specialty because they feel like they don't think that they can cut it. No pun intended. But.
Yeah, and I think that's, again, what are you making it mean? And that surgeon sounds like he's making it mean, I may be not good as a surgeon, you know. And if he's letting it be informative, you're only as good as your last case, and I'm going to use that, you know, to help me move into the next one confidently, right? What went well, I'm going to do that again. What didn't go well, I'm going to learn from that and improve upon it. But if you go in thinking my last case was bad, it's going to be that the next one is bad, right? Because your thoughts are going to be, I didn't do a good job, you know, and you're going to be insecure. And when you're insecure, you know how you show up, right? You can feel how that is physically and what you would do, and then it's going to come true again, right? It's going to be another bad outcome because our thoughts become our results. And so if you go into a case having just come from a bad case with the thought, I hope it doesn't go bad again, you know, it's going to, because you've primed the pump for that to be what happens. If you can come from that same case, nothing had changed, right? Same outcome, and say, I've learned from that. I know I will do this differently. I'm going to pay attention. I'm going to ask for help. I'm going to point this out. Chances are you'll feel more secure. You may not be confident yet, right? Because it's lingering, but you're not going to be insecure. You might be neutral. You might be curious. You might be cautious, but maybe not in a scarcity, dangerous way, but just cautious enough to like take one extra step, right? I'm going to look twice, cut once, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. And then the outcome can be better, right? Because I've learned from this. And so if it's a learning experience, then yes, like let that last case inform you for that piece, but not inform you again of the worthiness component. And that's where you see those trends, right? 3, 4, every case, the black cloud syndrome, you know, that's what's happening, right? Is our thoughts are going with us from room to room. Well, that would have been terrible. Hope this one goes better. And probably it won't, right? Because if you're just thinking, I hope it goes better, it's probably not going to go a whole lot better.
So, you know, it's interesting. We're talking about surgeon complications and stuff. One of my fellowship mentors, he's like, you know, just the nicest guy ever. He was the, I guess, quote unquote, surgeon complication guy for the whole hospital. And what that means is that whenever, across any specialty of surgery, he was an orthopedist, but across any specialty of surgery, whenever there was a complication, or, you know, something, some major event or something, this committee or this overarching group of people would tell him, hey, this surgeon had a pretty bad day. And his job was just to call that surgeon and offer to talk over coffee or beer or anything. And whether they took him up on it or not, you know, that was his job. He said, hey, I heard you had a, you know, a tough day. I don't know you, but if you ever want to talk or just do it. And he said, you know, a couple of people took him up on it, and it really helped them. These kind of programs, I think, are becoming more and more prevalent across institutions and across hospital systems. Have you noticed that too?
Yeah, they've been using a lot of, you know, peer-to-peer listening or coaching. And I think it's really helpful to be able to have somebody listen that has a general idea, right? Maybe not in the exact specialty, but we know the experience. And what I hope is they'll begin to empower those who are acting like your mentor did to listen and hold space. And that's kind of where coaching comes in, to not jump in the pool with them and kind of commiserate. Right. Like, I know that, like, that scrum tech's terrible, and that's probably what happened. But to be able to just listen and maybe offer back, just like we did here, you know, what was going on? You know, what do you think was happening around that? Notice, you know, what was in your control, what wasn't, to give them a little bit of the skill to listen and, right, listen and support and to reflect. And maybe not even tell them what to do differently, but just give them that piece. But absolutely, I see those programs. California Medical Association offered up a peer-to-peer coaching service for free for every physician in California because of COVID and, you know, the stressors around it. Interestingly, it hasn't been taken up as much because I think there is that stigma of, should I ask for help?
Yeah.
So I do think we need to be more directive. Like that program you mentioned, perhaps it's like, it's required, right? If you have this adverse outcome, take the 30 minutes and do this. And not to be another hoop to jump through, but almost to normalize it for the institution to say, it's not punitive, you know, this is not going on your record. This is a service and a benefit, and it's going to help you. And so we encourage you and almost, you know, we require you for your sake to do it. And I'm hoping that's what administration will begin to do. You know, it's just to make it normal, universally accessible, rather than you just do it when you messed up, because then you see it as like a black mark versus, nope, this is just a thing we do to support one another. and absolutely we can count on each other and hopefully get compensated. You know, we ask physicians to do a lot of things for free, and philanthropy is great, you know, and giving back is great, but that's where burnout comes too, because our light can only burn for so long, you know, until we put oil in the lamp, if we're going with that version of the analogy. So just noticing, we invest in a lot of things in healthcare, and investing in the health of the people providing the care is so important.
I remember, I remember in residency, you know, we would have modules once a month or so on mental health. And every single time, you know, we had one, I always ended up feeling more burned out than if I had not attended a burnout module. And I think that just speaks to kind of maybe the quality of these modules, that they're more or less mandatory, I think, for most GMEs now to have them. But I know you're involved in designing some of these newer ones, right? So kind of how do you think they should be done to be more effective? Because they're not all effective, you know, from personal experience.
Definitely. And I think what often happens is it seems like one more thing, right? It's like another mandatory lecture and time spent. Sometimes it's always an add-on. It's kind of layering on. So like, you know, if there's a wound, we can't just keep putting more and more and more dressings. Like sometimes we needed to heal from within. And so recognizing what is actually going on and what is contributing to the stress. And sometimes wellness is a scribe, you know, sometimes wellness is making sure you have a clear dismissal time. Sometimes wellness is looking at the ER and making it more efficient. You know, wellness isn't always the additional things, you know, like meditation and yoga and journaling. And those are great. Don't get me wrong with that at all. Totally useful. And they can be such amazing tools. But if we haven't gotten to the core of what's really, you know, distressing to our physicians, they seem like one more thing. And it seems like impossible to even engage with them. The programs we're looking to cultivate incorporate those as the and. And so we look at the core issues, you know, I'm looking at curriculum. So what things do people actually have a problem with, and how can we serve coaching as an intervention? And then sessions where we get one-on-one with the individual to talk about whatever it is that's going on with them, and illustrate tools that they can use to be successful, right? Going into any case, how do I cultivate confidence in the OR? How do I navigate my relationships when I'm on call? You know, we can talk about things that are really meaningful in a tangible way instead of kind of this surface level, pretending there aren't underlying issues, you know, contributing.
So if I could circle back just a little bit, we were talking about resiliency earlier, and one of the things that I kind of, mostly because of a research project I'm doing, but have been reading about, is kind of this concept of grit, and Angela Duckworth's concept of grit. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in your definition of resiliency and grit? And when you were in your capacity as a program director, did you specifically search out grittier residents, or do you think that even matters in terms of burnout?
Yeah, I think, again, how we connotate them really matters. So as a residency program director, I would have my interviewees race me in a word search. That was one of my interview pieces.
Wow.
And I'm kind of absurdly good at word searches. And it was mostly to see how they handled something totally random. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if they were competitive, and not even, I'm not looking for competitive necessarily, even in my specialty, a pretty collaborative space, but just to see how they can roll with the punches, you know? And so we do need to be flexible in medicine, because things are going to go not as we expect, you know? And so I think that is one way that I looked at things for residents. I looked at communication, and actually the residents that sometimes were most challenging to me were those who demanded, you know, more structure in knowing their schedule, knowing those pieces, but it actually informed me, and I ended up switching the schedule in our clinic to kind of block shifts, because we had morning people and late people. And so I said, why are we working outside of our strengths? You know, and if we can cover all hours of clinic in an effective way where everybody feels better. So those students who demanded that of me and the residents who sought that actually improved the situation for all of us. Like all my attendings got to work in their sweet spot of time. So I think grit, yes. Like we need to be able to withstand challenges that are appropriate. You know, the tough patient and maybe the long day and some of those, you know, flexible schedule requirements, but we don't have to just keep putting up with those toxic cultures and abuses. And my hope is that as I speak to this new generation of people coming through medicine, that it will naturally begin to shift. You know, I'm seeing that there's less of a tolerance for that coming through. And what is your hypothesis in your research project, out of curiosity?
Oh, we're just looking at grit in relation to patient outcomes after hip surgery. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the preliminary stuff that we found is we're basically that grittier patients do better because they stick to the PT. We haven't proven that yet, but they'll stick to the PT, they'll stick to the rehab, and kind of push through, you know, the downturns in their post-op stuff. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
what I'd be curious topic. About is it what's their mindset? Do they think they're going to do well? Do they think they have the capacity to keep up with PT? Are they telling themselves every day, I can handle these exercises, I'm choosing these exercises, you know, these are going to allow me to walk better, you know? So that's kind of where I would be encouraged mm-hmm. and curious about what is helping those patients to do well.
Yeah.
We always joke in orthopedic surgery that farmers make the best patients. You know, farmers in the Midwest, you do anything to them and they're still going to be active and still going to do their day-to-day things. So mm-hmm.
interesting. And farmers probably have the underlying thought, right? I'm going to get this done because I have to, right? Chores, like this is the daily maintenance, this is the routine. And so they carry that kind of mantra with them through their day, and that's generalization. But as, you know, farmers I've known personally, you know, they're choosing that work and they're choosing the maintenance of it for the love of it. And they can apply that then, like that thought's available to them in their recovery phase.
So we have physician coaches. Do we have patient coaches too? Because a lot of the stuff you're talking about might work. You know, talking about confidence. Like to coach patients?
Yeah.
I know a lot of patients that would benefit from it.
You do some of the neuromusculoskeletal stuff, right? Isn't that, mm-hmm. is that part of it?
Like I said, I feel like I've been coaching patients all along, and it's been interesting. You know, I do hands-on treatments, often for pain, and patients associate their improvement with the treatment. They're like, oh, I came and you did this and you fixed me. And I always want to say, no, like I facilitated it. I was with you, but your body did that, right? Like your body has the capacity to be well. And actually during this time I've been seeing patients virtually, it's expanded because I get to say to them really and truly, like you have the power to do this. Like, let's look at what's actually contributing to your pain. And I've seen some major shifts. You know, patients I've seen for a long time make some new progress that we actually were limited in when we were in-person care. And I think totally, you know, some physician coaches use it with their patients, you know, just as part of the counseling. They have a new way to present something to them. And absolutely, I think that's going to be a space in medicine, especially surgery, be a great place, right? Because you often have that pre-op plan, the post-op management. And so to have that mindset coach, right? You know, we have the PT. Yep. And they could even do it. We can empower PTs to apply. Like going,
I think that's where a lot of it goes right now.
You know, our thought could be here. And if we just give PTs those tools, you know, like some of those phrasings that can be helpful to them, it might be really useful.
Yeah, no, because I mean, a lot of these patients that we kind of broadly group into like catastrophizers, as surgeons, we don't really know what to do with them, honestly. We're not great.
Yeah, we're not.
And our default is to send them to pain management or send them to psych. Or if they're therapists, like you said, a lot of this falls to the therapist of seeing them multiple times a week and guiding them through the rehab. But if they don't know how to do it, then that patient's kind of stuck. So, it's interesting. You know, in sports medicine, this is kind of growing. There's a lot of growing research about the psychological return to sport and the fear of return as being a negative predictor of outcomes, and especially after ACL tears. So, you know, sports psychology it's kind of a growing field now, too. So, I don't know. It's interesting. It's a new area that I think we're hopefully going to see a lot of growth in the future.
Yeah. And we see coaches, right? The best athletes in the world have 5 coaches for all those different pieces. And it's great to use it on that elite end. And we often use it for the catch up. You know, it's like when I have a problem, I have a coach. But how about in between? Like all of us probably need some support. And if it was just baseline for your patients, and I would just say this, catastrophizers, consider if it's also that you expect it to be different than it is, right? If you expect, ideal patient, right? To just follow your orders and do this and recover on this rate. And that when it doesn't, that's when we become frustrated. So to also give yourself a little space to say, okay, like some people are going to have a different experience. You know, it doesn't mean anything's gone wrong. It's just for them, can also make you a little bit less stressed or irritated with what's going on.
So maybe there's value too in us learning how to be patient coaches in a way. Yeah, you know, for our post-operative patients that come to our clinic, and even for pre-operative appointments, just to get them mentally ready for what's to come, would you say?
Definitely. If you can take any of these little pearls with you, you know, and the pattern is, we saw our thoughts create our feelings, and our feelings create our actions. And so if you want them to do something, finding out what feeling gets them there, and you're not gonna spend 30 minutes with them, but you can help them think about when was the time you were most, you know, productive or most active and most willing to cooperate with something. How are you feeling, right? And see if they can draw from that. That's one simple way to get them there. And also just allow, right? Allow for any reaction, because it's scary, right? You see surgery every day. Mm-hmm. Patients might see it once in their life and it's pretty terrifying. Like, they cut me open, I have this scar. Is it gonna get infected? Yep. Am I gonna walk again? How's it gonna be? And so just remembering they have a totally different experience of this than you do. And even just that little bit of space around it, allowing for feelings, allowing for fear, allowing for hesitation, allowing for resistance can actually help them to dissipate. You know, they might let go of those feelings a little bit better, and they're like, just do it, right? If you don't do your therapy, you can't leave the hospital. Like, you know, we kind of get into that space.
Yeah.
And so notice that there's a little room if you allow for a response that it might not be so starkly contrasted to your expectation.
Yeah. And I have to say, as a group, surgeons are terrible at that, because we're go, 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 room to room to room.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of time for feelings. And
It doesn't have to be long, you know?
Right.
And even if, you might not even verbalize it. You might just be knowing, right? Oh, they're just feeling that way because they're thinking this, you know? Mm-hmm. And you don't have to, it doesn't have to be a problem.
Yeah.
You know? So now circle back to administrative burden.
But if it got them to do the therapy, you know, then it might actually shorten your course, right? If you think about the long game.
Right. Yeah. True.
Yeah. No, I wanted to ask about the stigma that we talked about earlier, specifically going to physicians. And I know there's a lot, mental health disorders are underdiagnosed in physicians, you know, depression, anxiety. I don't have the stats to prove it, but at least in my experience, I would say it's underdiagnosed. And at least the reasoning that I've thought through is that there's a stigma of being a doctor that has a mental health disorder, and whether you can successfully take care of patients if you're dealing with your own mental health problems. So you see this, you know, every day. What has been your experience with this?
Definitely there's the resistance to ask for help. Like I said, even in coaching seems like it'd be a little bit less, you know, stigmatized.
Yeah.
Even there, you almost have to tell people like it's okay, or frame it differently. Like it's for fun or it's for improvement, rather than just saying like, it's okay to have a person supporting you. And as far as more severe mental health management, absolutely. And there are stigmas, right? You get written up, or it's on your record. And so changing that is a place where, you know, systemic change needs to shift. And in the meantime, we do have to kind of be brave and say, you know what, even if it's on my record, I am going to seek care, because I see the outcomes, right? I see that far end of the continuum, like we noticed, and I'm not willing to go there, even if it means some kind of loss of job. And then you have ground to stand on, right? We can then fight that battle separately. But I do encourage physicians to call it out for one another, you know, and not in a punitive or judgmental way, but hey, like, you're not coming to, well, gatherings don't happen anymore. You seem different at work, or like, how is everything going? Like, and maybe sometimes even offering, and you don't have to make anything up, but we probably all have rough days, admitting to it, right? Man, I'm feeling down. Like last week for me was this overwhelm week. And I was like, okay, everything was just big. And, you know, can I do this? And being able to say to somebody, this is happening for me, you know, and they might say, yeah, like, me too, I hear you. And so offering it when you are experiencing, instead of just, you know, suffering in silence, speaking out, even if it's not seeking formal help, just say, man, I'm having a tough time, you know, and offering that for other people, and to say, I know, it's totally normal. And the other thing is, I think we think that it's supposed to be good all the time, and it's really not, you know.
Yeah.
Life is really 50-50, and that can seem really upsetting. It's like, what? I'm gonna spend half my time like in misery.
Yeah.
But really, it just means that there's balance, you know, and there is no good without bad. And knowing that it's temporary, then what it means is when things are bad, it's temporary. And you might think, but then when things are good, they're going to go away too. Like, yes, but you don't have to wait for it to happen, because you know, right, this is going to ebb and flow. So you don't have to spend all your time anticipating in the good moment, because we'll do that. Like, everything's going really well, and we're like, oh man, something's going to happen. And instead, just know, enjoy when it's being good, because yes, it's going to shift, but that's okay. And then it's going to shift back, and that's okay too. So I think, of course, there's going to be some bad outcomes, right? If you're operating enough, there are going to be some adverse outcomes. So just allowing for that, rather than thinking something has gone wrong if you're having a down day. But if you're having only down days, right, it should be 50-50. Yep. And so notice that too. And that's when you can reach out and maybe just start with a colleague.
Yeah.
But certainly, I would say don't be scared to ask for help on whatever formal level. And if you do get punished or written up for it, that's when you need to be an advocate and look for an ally in that process.
So I guess we've transitioned to more, you know, from kind of run-of-the-mill burnout to more serious kind of depression. And you've also mentioned physician suicides earlier in the talk. And so you said if you're having more bad days than good and you're a string of bad days, maybe that's something to look out for. What else can we look out for to know that we're kind of, you know, we're really going into dangerous territory, so to speak?
Yeah, certainly, you know, if you're disengaging, like with your family, if you are having that just lack of desire to go to work, if you no longer have those go-tos, you know, for me, it's exercise. So if I ever didn't want to exercise or didn't find relief in exercise, I would say, okay, something is not right, you know, because to me, like, that's a guarantee. I trust myself to do it regularly, and I know how I feel with it. So if I knew that it stopped, you know, I would look there. And certainly on the extremes, if you're having, you know, suicidal ideation, certainly. And Dr. Weibel, whose article you referenced, you know, has the physician suicide hotline. That is her area of expertise. It does exist. And there are these free resources like the CMA has, you know, for physicians. And so just gaining that awareness, you know, calling out for help, and it can be anonymous. It doesn't have to be as formal in that way, but look for that spectrum. You know, when are my usual tools for getting out of a funk no longer working? And then look for that string, right? Like if it's all bad days, then you're not in the 50-50 anymore, you know? And so see why that is and see if you can, you shift yourself out of it. And if not, you know, that's a time to seek some external support.
Let's talk a little bit about prevention here, burnout prevention. And you mentioned exercise for you. You're a CrossFitter, right? And that—
Yeah, I own a gym. Yeah.
Hurts my soul. But exercise is very important. Me and Jay are both, you know, I think that's one of the things for us too, was that, you know, exercise. What are some of the other things burnout prevention wise? We talked about kind of the, you know, self-mindfulness and keeping control of what you can control, but what other tips do you have?
Yeah, those are definitely key. And like I said, those mindfulness tools, yoga and meditation are great. And those are great. You can pepper them in. We often think if I'm not doing something for an hour, you know, it's not worth it, but little doses, you know, 10 minutes to reset can be really useful. Of course, looking at baseline things like sleep, you know, especially in the surgical world, you might think, oh, I only need X amount of sleep. And there is a spectrum, right? People can get away with and survive on less, but look at that. You know, am I committing to restorative sleep regularly? Engaging with people, you know, so staying connected, especially in this time when we can't necessarily physically gather. Mm-hmm. That is important, but also the idea of just thinking you're connected to someone. So thinking about those people who are important to you, reaching out to them periodically, you know, at baseline. I did a run last year. I wrote a letter a day for a while just to like see who I could get to. Yeah. And it was so nice. And I got them back, you know, and seeing people's handwriting is such a fascinating thing because often, you know, we email and we text. And so just looking at ways you can do that, maybe seeing like, can I carve out 10 minutes like to read an actual book? You know, and see if that's possible for you, something that's interesting. And noticing that those things that we don't always think of as appropriate, like watching a show, you know, or indulging in some treat, if you enjoy it and don't punish yourself for it, that can be therapeutic as well. You know, like I'm just choosing to enjoy this and maybe setting a little bit of a boundary, right? Because we know binging of shows can be a thing, but allowing yourself to schedule in downtime, you know, where there is nothing expected of you, you can't choose from any of those things, can be so important. And then of course, looking at the structural change really is wellness. And so what are the actual pieces in my day? Maybe it's scheduling, maybe it's organizing my, you know, food more, you know, thoughtfully in advance so that I have good nourishment going to work. So those actually do help with burnout prevention as well.
How important is nutrition, do you think? Because I know, at least for me, I'm a depression, anxiety eater for sure. Like, I don't know. Is there any evidence behind that?
Nutrition is so important, right? It's fueling everything in our body. And there's no one right way to eat, which we can see. There's many recommendations, but we can all agree fewer processed foods. You know, we can often look at timing of eating, like how close we're eating to sleep. And then like you noted, are we eating for food fuel or emotionally?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's okay, right? The indulgence, like I had a bad day. I want some ice cream. I'm just going to do it, you know, enjoy it. And then move on if that's happening all the time, right? We've created a different relationship with food. But choosing to eat with intention, I think, is so important. If you can, you know, eat a diverse array of food, if you can eat locally, that's really great. You know, we have kind of this, you know, weird relationship with food and what's available seasonally. And then you can decide what works for you. We have the plant-based squirrel right across. So we have the paleo squirrel that's grain-free. See what fuels you and be willing to experiment. You probably find this with your patients. You know, they're going to have certain ways to eat that sustain them. And what's going to work is the one that you'll stick with, you know, that keeps you out of that process realm. And I would say for surgeons, probably having some plan in advance. And we have all of these services now that you can have high quality food delivered, you know, if it is a scheduling issue. But I think trying to put more intention behind eating is holding equal weight to some of the quality of what we're actually ingesting.
Yeah, good point.
Awesome. So this is not related to surgery or medicine, but as a dad of two young kids, how can I build up their mental health as they grow up into adults? This is actually important to me.
Totally. Well, the best thing you can do is support your own, right? So like anything, the modeling is really the best that we can do. And kids, as we know, like their brains are developing differently. And so we have some physician coaches who specialize in parenting, but the coaching isn't necessarily for the kids, right? It's to support the parents. And again, noticing with your kids, like, what are you expecting them to do? Like, we get into battles with our kids, it's because they're doing something other than what we thought they should be doing. Like my kids, I took them out for ice cream. I'm thinking, this is great. I'm a super nice mom. And they were all really grumpy. And I'm like, why are you grumpy? Like, this is a really nice thing. I was mad, you know? And so I'm yelling at them. I thought, well, that's not really helpful, because the whole point was like to hang out and have a nice time. And then I realized I can enjoy it. Right? I can enjoy being out with them for ice cream, and they could not enjoy it. And it actually made it so much better. You know, it's like, okay, I did my best. Next time I'll listen and say maybe a different activity is preferred. But recognizing that it's usually, again, our expectation for them and the mismatch that causes the strife. And it's going to be cyclical, right? You're going to have great days and not great days. And you can offer these to them, right? How are you feeling right now, depending on how old they are? You know, and I do that with my kids, and they'll often say like, oh God, are we talking about thoughts again, Mom? But you can start to illustrate that for them, you know, because they can think they have no control over anything, right? Kids, like people tell them where to go, what to do, what to eat. And so trying to give them some space to have some control where they can, maybe it's choices. Maybe it's like you have time to spend with them. You let them decide what to do, as long as it's not like crazy or dangerous. And see if you can start to give them some autonomy. I think allowing them that is really helpful. But the best thing you can do is work on it with yourself and show up that way. You know, show up more in control of your feelings and awareness of your thoughts.
So Dr. Beeke, so this last question probably has nothing to do with mental health. Or maybe it has everything to do with mental health. But what is your favorite bone?
Favorite bone, probably the sacrum.
That
we
is
we spend the most time there, I think, in treatments. Yeah,
that is really
nice.
It's a powerhouse, you know. We look
it
at
it. Really
MP.
Is.
Yeah.
That's actually a really important bone. You know,
that is one.
The dural attachments, right? You know, like I always found it fascinating. We had a dissection, and they took it down and they lifted right the whole spinal column, like just from C2 in the sacrum. Like that's pretty rad, you know.
Yeah.
So. I go with the sacrum.
That's a great answer. We ask every guest that question, and that's probably one of the more fascinating answers we've gotten. Yeah. That's awesome.
Half of them say coracoid, half of them say femur, and then you're the first one that says.
Oh, man. They got to branch out.
Yeah, seriously.
That's my thought about it. It's okay. Seriously. I support them in their decisions.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. So,
that's a great question, though.
Yeah. Well, all right, great. Dr. Beeke, so this osteopathiclife.com, this Osteopathic Life podcast, author, you're on Kevin MD, you have a blog on the website too. How else can our listeners get in touch with you if they want to?
Yeah, I'm same thing, same name on Facebook and LinkedIn, Instagram. I haven't learned the whole Twitter thing, maybe someday.
Yeah, you gotta do it. It's a terrible place.
Oh my gosh. And I do have programs, you know, so if there's interest in bringing coaching to your institution, that's one of my sweet spots. And so creating a program that's specific to your institution and access through CME is another way, trying to bring access to coaching. And so if anybody's interested in that, please contact me. I have a whole team of coaches working with me, and that's our mission, is to bring health to medicine.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate your time. This was a very enlightening podcast and enlightening hour, and we appreciate that. And I got a lot. I think we could do this for another couple hours. So we're going to have to do this again sometime.
Yeah,
so.
That'd be great. Thanks awesome. For having me.
Yeah. So thank you for coming on again, thisosteopathiclife.com, and get in touch with you. And, you know, hopefully we'll do this again.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Thank you,
Dr. Vicky. And that'll do it for us. I hope you guys enjoyed that one. It was very fun to make, very interesting. And it's one I'm going to have to listen to again. Thank you to Dr. Beakey for giving us an hour of her time. Like I said before, if you want to get in touch with Dr. Beakey and you're interested in maybe signing up or, you know, getting involved with a physician life coach, you can do so at her website, thisosteopathiclife.com. She's not a sponsor of the show. This was purely out of interest in discussing mental health, and I hope you guys enjoyed the podcast. If you want to get in touch with us and let us know how much you like the show or how much you don't like the show, you can do so at Twitter at OrthoTalkPod. You can email us, theorthopodcast@gmail.com. Our website is orthotalkpod.com. All of our episodes can be found there. Like I said before, we are showcasing residency programs. If you want to get in touch with us about that, do so at the places I mentioned above. We're showing those on our website and at Twitter. Hope you guys are enjoying the show. If you really do, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really does help us out, and we appreciate all of those. And hope you guys are enjoying what we're doing, and we'll have more for you next week. And thank you for the opportunity.